thousands of researchers, patients, and activists are gathering in Washington, D.C. this weekend for the International AIDS Conference. Advances in treatment and access to drugs have seen deaths drop worldwide, but it's still estimated 35 million people are living with HIV. On the treatment front, the FDA has just approved the first drug shown to prevent HIV infection, and the Wall Street Journal is reporting that scientists are beginning to look for a cure, something that has been thought all but impossible. Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, will open the plenary science session at the conference. We reached him on his cell phone. And Dr. Fauci, we know that there are treatments, drugs to control the disease, but what about an actual cure? You say there are formidable challenges. What are they?
Well, the first thing is that the virus has the uncanny capability of inserting itself into the genes of individual target cells in the body. And you can prevent that virus from multiplying by therapies which have been highly successful and, in fact, have led to, in many cases, normal lifespan for an individual. But to eradicate the vestiges of virus that have essentially genetically integrated themselves into some of the genes in one's own cells, that's a formidable challenge, because how do you do that without damaging the person themselves? That's the real challenge, because the kinds of infections that we've been able to cure generally don't become part of the genetic makeup of the person.
In the meantime, the FDA has approved Truvada for prevention of HIV infection,
right,
and it's been in use for treatment. Tell us how it works.
Well, Truvada is a combination in one pill of two drugs that are part of the broader combination to actually treat infected individuals. It is being used now and was shown in a clinical trial, a couple of clinical trials, one in men who have sex with men and another in heterosexual individuals, that if you give an uninfected person a pill a day and they adhere to it regularly, and that's one of the problems, that people don't like taking a pill a day, you can dramatically decrease the likelihood that that person will be infected sexually. The important issue to point out is that this is referred to as pre-exposure prophylaxis, hence the word PrEP, but it is not for everyone. It is not meant to be a substitute for the other combinations of preventions that we have that work well, like behavioral modification, like the consistent and proper use of condoms. This is only for select people who, for one reason or other, are at a very high risk and have not been successful in utilizing the other prevention modalities. So it's more of an add-on of another tool in the toolkit of prevention, as opposed to something that's going to solve the prevention problem.
And is there a concern that if it's taken only occasionally instead of the way it's meant to be taken, daily, that it might lead to the development of drug-resistant strains of the virus?
So this drug itself, even though it's very good for preventing, is not an optimal drug for the treatment of infection. And so the bad scenario would be that someone is careless in not regularly taking the prevention pill, they wind up getting infected, don't know that they're infected, and then continue to take the pill thinking they're taking it for prevention when they're already infected. Then you get a problem, because then you're inadequately treating an already infected person, which is a perfect setup for the development of resistance.
Let's talk about some of the affected communities in the U.S. African-American males have some pretty shocking statistics. By the age of 25, one in four had HIV. By the age of 40, 60% of black gay men have HIV. That's according to the Black AIDS Institute. What's going on in this community?
Well, there are a number of things. Here in Washington, D.C., where I'm standing right now, this is a predominantly African-American community that don't have as good access to health services. There's an extraordinary amount of stigma associated with being gay in the African-American community, much more so than in the white community. So there's stigma, there's lack of adequate services, There's economic considerations. So when you have a city that's predominantly an African-American city that has all of those other issues of stigma and lack of access, mistrust of the medical community, those are the perfect setup to have this high rate of infection.
And is that why there are 50,000 new infections every year in the U.S., given how much we know about preventing infection at this point?
Well, we've got to do much, much better than that, and that's the reason for trying to pull out all the stops in prevention. We have, back in the early, in the 80s when we were at the peak, there used to be about 120,000, 130,000 new infections each year. Now we're down to 50,000, but that's an unacceptable plateau because it has plateaued at that level for now well over 10 years. We've got to do better than that, and there are programs now that are aggressively going out, seeking out people, voluntarily testing them and linking them to care. And the reason for that is that there are 1.2 million people in this country who are infected. 20% of them do not know that they are infected. And the overwhelming majority of new infections come from a person who does not know that he or she is infected and who inadvertently transmit that infection to their sexual partner. That's the reason why testing and accessing people and getting them into a testing program and linking them to care are critical. We have the scientific tools that, if properly implemented, they can turn around the trajectory of the pandemic. And it's up to the political will, the resources, getting a global commitment to do that. It's not going to be easy. It's not going to happen in a year or two, but we can start going in the right direction. And it wasn't until recently that we could actually say that in a science-based way.
So, Dr. Fauci, you're pointing toward policy and healthcare policy in the U.S. and globally as a way that we need to help attack this pandemic.
There's no doubt about that. There has to be implementation of programs that we know work. It's going to be particularly difficult in countries that don't have the health infrastructure to do it, but it's not impossible because we've seen successes in places like Rwanda and in Botswana, and we've obviously seen successes in the United States, but we've also seen some challenges, such as here in Washington, D.C.
Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, will give one of the key addresses at the International AIDS Conference in Washington, D.C. Dr. Fauci, thank you for speaking with us.
It's my pleasure.
We've been talking about the latest advances in the treatment and prevention of HIV and AIDS ahead of the start of the International AIDS Conference this weekend in Washington, D.C. Among those attending will be 23-year-old Tracy Jarrett. She's a correspondent for Global Post, and she's just returned from a trip to South Africa, aimed at finding out what the U.S. can learn from health workers and activists there. Go to hereandnow.org, and we'll link you to her Global Post reporting. Tracy joins us from the NPR studios in Washington. Tracy, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Tracy, the first blog post in your series tells your own story. Your mother died from HIV/AIDS when you were 5. To what extent is this a personal journey for you?
Well, I think that my personal story has really motivated me to learn more about this disease and others like me, because for a long time it was something that I didn't know about and that I never really took time to explore, but I think it's heavily shaped me. So I think that it was definitely a motivating factor in my reporting as I went along the way.
You visited both Johannesburg and Cape Town while in South Africa, which is believed to have the largest number of people living with HIV/AIDS of any country in the world. And the health workers and activists there have learned to do more with less. And you were blogging about some of the impressive programs that they have that are run by HIV-positive women. Tell us about those.
Right. So in Cape Town specifically, I looked at a couple of programs, one being Mothers to Mothers, which takes HIV-positive mothers and basically educates them on how to counsel and educate other expectant mothers. And so they actually have a lot of responsibilities. They're located in local clinics and townships, as well as having offices in main hospitals in the city. And when mothers are pregnant, they go and they get tested for HIV, and they automatically along the way will stop at a Mothers to Mothers if there's an office there and talk with somebody. And if they happen to be positive, they kind of get a mentor, a peer educator to help them, you know, make really hard decisions. Am I going to breastfeed my child? Am I not going to breastfeed my child? How do I make sure my child does not come out positive? What do I do if he or she does? And I think that it really is a healing mechanism, because the mothers who are mentor mothers are able to help people and cope with their own stories. And then, you know, the mothers who are coming to the offices are getting the help and education that they need. So I thought that that was really great. And also, there are other programs that the South African government and organizations are really trying to invest in, one of which being Sizophila, which means We Will Survive in COSA, where they're taking HIV-positive men and women and having them peer educate and counsel and do home visits to make sure that people are adhering to their treatment, which can be a very difficult thing. And I think that they're seeing a lot of success with these programs because people respond to empathy and being able to relate to others.
You also write about an HIV-positive mother and daughter team running a similar kind of program. It's called SMART in Harlem, New York. But otherwise, it doesn't sound like this is a common type of program in the U.S. And I'm wondering, to what extent do you think programs like that could help people in U.S. cities where HIV infection rates are rising?
I think that there are people who recognize this and really want to start programs just like SMART in East Harlem, but the problem is making sure that they can receive the funding that they need to do so. But I do think that if people have a place where they can come, it's part of their community, there's others in the community who are going to be there, and there are people there who are willing to mentor them and empower them, that they can relate to their stories, I think that is definitely helpful, because I think that so much about dealing with HIV, whether it be adhering to your medication and your treatment or telling your family member, disclosure is a big issue, and just knowing what you need to do to stay healthy, I think a lot of that has to do with being able to relate with somebody and talk to them and see somebody as an example and have someone really understand where you're coming from. And I think sometimes it's really hard for people to open up in that way to doctors or nurses who, you know, they come in and they see outside of their community for one visit every 3 months. There's not the same connection there.
What's the stigma like today in South Africa surrounding HIV/AIDS?
So one thing I noticed is amongst women, there's kind of less stigma. Women talk to one another. Everyone gets tested if you're pregnant. But amongst men, there's still very much an attitude of denial and not wanting to let somebody know if you are HIV positive or not going to be tested. A lot of men do what we call being tested by proxy. So if my wife has HIV, well, I'll assume that I have it, but I'm not going to tell other people. And I think that's very much a masculinity thing. And then I think it's very hard for people to disclose there to their family members because of different cultural values and not wanting to be judged or not wanting to not get work or have to tell their work. And I think that's very much similar to what people face here. I think it can be very hard to reveal that about yourself because there are people who still think you're HIV positive, you have AIDS, your life is over. And I think that's not the case. So I think that these community programs kind of are helping to change that, but it's still definitely an issue.
Tracy, in one of your final blog posts from your time in South Africa, you muse about whether if you had been born HIV positive, how would you have chosen to handle this secret, which so many kids don't reveal, so many adults don't reveal. After this experience, what do you think you would have done?
I would like to think that I would have a supportive enough family and friends to feel comfortable disclosing my status and that I would seek the education I needed in order to become comfortable enough to say, you know, this is my situation. I can say that one of the things I was most nervous about in writing this whole series was my grandma and how she would react.
Yeah, you write in your first blog post that she was scared about you sharing your story publicly and that she's been trying to protect you from any stigma that might come with your mother's diagnosis. So yeah, what's been your grandmother's reaction?
To be honest, I tried to hide my blog posts from her because I was very nervous. The last thing I would ever want to do is disappoint my grandma. And I was very scared what her reaction might be if she read some of the personal things that I reveal in my blog post. But being the computer savvy woman that she is, she Googled them and she read each and every post. And she was very, very proud of me. And that meant a whole lot to me.
That's Global Post correspondent Tracy Jarrett. Thanks, Tracy.
Thank you.